the majority of the funding that it takes to run the station comes from listeners. That's the bottom line. And one thing that we know is the kind of federal and state support that we've had in the past, that's the past, and we are never going to go back. The model for funding public broadcasting in this country is changing, and it is moving increasingly toward listener funding. And that's really not so bad. And we like the idea that we are answerable to the listeners. That's the way we like it. We certainly don't want to be answerable to advertisers. We like to be answerable to people who use the service. So if the programs that you hear on the radio station are important to you, Focus 580, Afternoon Magazine, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, all of the other shows that we have, they also need your support. If you're not a friend of WILL, a member of this organization of people who have given us their money, we hope that you would change that today. We have folks who will take the call. It'll take about 2 minutes. It's very easy and it's very important to us. 244-9455. That is the number to call. You can do that now and make a pledge. And if not now, well, today. We'd appreciate it. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about nanotechnology, a subject that we have discussed, I suppose, off and on this program in the past. And every time we do it, I think that we actually have to begin by talking about what it is we're talking about, because I think a lot of people don't quite understand it. The long and the short of it is we're talking about a developing, emerging kind of field that a lot of people think could well be the basis for a new kind of industrial revolution. Perhaps some people would argue that it's already on the way. So we're talking here this morning with three researchers, all from the University of Illinois. Irfan Ahmad, who is the assistant director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the U of I. Brian Cunningham, associate professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at the U of I, and John Rogers. He's professor of materials science and engineering. He's also founder, professor of engineering, and professor of chemistry at the U of I. And I'm pleased that they could all be here in the studio to talk with us. Questions are welcome. I'm sure that if someone would like to call in with some nano questions, they will do their best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Well, thank you all three
very much.
As I said, I think to start, it's probably important that we give people a basic kind of definition, of understanding of what it is we're talking about. Nanotechnology, it does get some coverage in the media. Perhaps people have read articles about it. But I think that still there people will not be sure what it is that we're talking about. So let's start there.
Yeah, okay. So this is John Rogers. I think the best way to start to think about what nanotechnology is to sort of consider what the term nano sort of refers to. It characterizes a certain range of length scales, and these length scales are so small that it's difficult to think clearly about them. And so one way to begin is to kind of step through a range of size scales associated with things you may be familiar with. And so sort of on the very large scale, you know, in terms of the things that we'll be talking about today, is the diameter of a human hair. That's about 100 microns in diameter. And there are 1,000 microns per millimeter. So we're talking about, a diameter of about 0.1 millimeters. So that's, you know, on the long scale. Stepping down a little bit, a red blood cell has a diameter of about 1 micron. And 1 micron is equal to 1,000 nanometers. And so nanometers is the characteristic length scale of nanotechnology. On the small side, the size, characteristic size of an atom, which, you know, is a constituent of molecules and everything that we interact with in the world, that has a characteristic size of about 0.1 nanometers. So nanotechnology really refers to objects and devices that have sizes that range between the size of a single atom and about the size of a red blood cell, just to set the length scales. And so why are people interested in objects that have those kinds of dimensions? And so one issue is just sort of a practical engineering consideration is that, if you have smaller component objects or smaller devices, then you can put lots more of them in a given space than you could if those devices were larger. And so from the standpoint of just being able to pack lots of things into small spaces, nanotechnology is of interest. And you can see examples of that in all kinds of devices that are used to store data. You know, in your computer hard drive, you want to be able to pack as many bits as possible per unit area into that hard drive so that, you know, your laptop is lighter and easier to carry around. And so nanotechnology is an intrinsic component of storage technologies. Another example of that is in the microprocessor that, you know, forms the brains of your computer, being able to put more and more component elements, switching devices, transistors per unit area allows that computer to be able to do more things more quickly. Mm-hmm. And so there are advantages in the sense that nanotechnology allows you to do more per unit area. Probably the more interesting thing from a scientific standpoint is that by structuring materials on these length scales, you can achieve and you can tune and adjust the intrinsic properties of a material without changing the atomic constituents of it. And that's a slightly more subtle concept, but I think it's substantially what drives a lot of interest in nanotechnology is being able to attune physical properties such as the color of a material or the way that it transports electrons or the way that it interacts with magnetic fields can be tuned in very exquisite ways by controlling shape and size on these length scales.
So I think for me that the one of the things I latch onto is just this very idea that you've touched on, and that is the idea that it's being able to build something using building blocks that are very small, much smaller than in the past perhaps we could have done. And what that does is it gives you an opportunity to then construct something that has different properties than you could have in the past, and that it's something that crosses a wide range of disciplines. We've talked about things like microelectronics, but it also other kinds of material sciences, I'm sure ceramics, textiles, all sorts of stuff like that. It gets into medicine. It gets into developing new drugs. It gets into developing new medical devices. So it can be everything from something that might be used to treat heart disease to making pants that you can pour wine on and the wine doesn't stain the pants. So then I think that people need to appreciate that the potential range of applications, and I suppose that's why so many scientists and people who might then develop commercial products get so excited, is that there are an awful lot of different kinds of things that you could do with this. Almost, it's a matter of, well, you know, how good's your imagination? It can take you in an awful lot of different directions.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that what you're expressing there is the very next point that I was going to make, which is really addressing the question of, you know, okay, so we've established that nanotechnology and nanoscale materials are interesting. You do all these different things. Why now? You know, why not 20 years ago? You know, why is it happening now? And the reason why it's happening now is exactly what you said, is that the multidisciplinary set of skills that have developed over the years are converging on this set of length scales. And you can see it happening over the last few decades in chemistry, where sort of the ability to assemble, you know, small collections of atoms into well-defined molecules with sort of molecular scale control over the geometry of those objects has increased over the years in the sense that bigger and bigger molecules are possible now. The synthetic skills of a chemist have extended to very large scale molecules, proteins and DNA and very large biomolecules. At the same time, you had that trend going on towards longer length scales, bigger objects in chemistry. You've had in the electrical engineering and material science worlds a trend towards smaller and smaller objects, being able to build transistors that have smaller and smaller feature sizes using sort of top-down kind of machining and etching and lithographic approaches. And what's happening now is that those length scales are getting to converge. So the ability to build molecules is approaching the size scales of the kinds of structures that people can etch directly into the elements of a transistor. Mm-hmm. And so it's that chemistry and electrical engineering coming together and biology, of course, course, involves, you know, a whole host of objects that have these kinds of sizes. That's really driving a lot of the excitement in this field. And I think there are tremendous opportunities for, you know, both science and technology to emerge from it.
Yeah. We have a caller here. And I'll tell you what, why don't we bring them in the conversation and we can talk some more. This caller is in Indiana, so we'll get to them on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. It's getting to sound like an update promotions thing going on here, and I'd just like to know if there are any disadvantages, such as the efficiency of moving these small things around. Does it take any hazardous chemicals to do certain parts of things you're talking about? Anything along those lines that are negative?
Okay. What's the downside? Are there potential downsides of the technology?
Well, I think one has to be cautious anytime you're exploring new science or new technology, and I think one has to be prudent about assessing the risks and the dangers. And there's certainly a substantial amount of research going on in that field, looking at the toxicity, for example, of various classes of nanomaterials. But I don't think that we're entering a fundamentally new phase. I mean, these are varieties of materials that have existed for a very long time. They're being assembled in a way that they haven't been in the past to make functional devices and so on. But I think in many cases, the materials themselves have been around and been in our environment for, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. And so I think that while you have to be cognizant of possible, you know, downsides and risks and so on, I don't think there's cause for, you know, being overly concerned about that to the extent that you kind of stifle additional developments and research in this area.
So sort of the parallel that I think about is that some of the questions that people raise about genetic engineering. And they say they at least raise the question, if you develop something that is a novel life form that didn't exist before, essentially you're talking about an introduced species. And we know how difficult and how problematic that can be when that happens now. We take something from one ecosystem and put it into another where it never existed. Is there anything like that that anybody even thinks about the possibility that you would develop something that did not already exist in nature that then would be problematic because you were introducing something into nature that didn't exist before? Or is it not that kind of a thing?
Well, let me jump in here. One of the discussions that we have had is and has been also prompted by the NSF in terms of the societal implications of nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. And this is primarily led from the previous experience of dealing with biotechnology, where there was a backlash and there was no public awareness created. And a technology like biotechnology is not being accepted even in Europe and in parts of Africa and other areas. So that it has led for the researchers and the policymakers to actually start discussing these issues and concerns head-on while the research is going on. As John pointed out, I mean, there are definitely the upsides to technology, and there are some negative issues which can come about with technology. But we have to be careful in assessing the implications of the technology and how do we address them by creating standards and parameters and features where issues like toxicity of nanoparticles and the sort would have to be discussed. So to backtrack a little bit, the center here, which is hosting this workshop that we were talking before the program, is the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology on campus. Its goal is to actually promote both research and education, and then to also bring about the discussion related to the nanotechnology the implications. And by implications, we mean the societal effect, the healthcare effect, the legal effect, the economic effect, and all of those. So we've started working with more than 7 colleges on campus now. We're discussing at various levels all of these activities and they started talking about it. Of course, there are other campuses around the country who are discussing it and with some promptings and fundings from the National Science Foundation. This workshop we're bringing in on May 5th and 6th on campus is covering nanomaterials, nanomaterials, nano devices, nanoelectronics, and bio-nanotechnology application. And when we bring into bio-nanotechnology application, we talk about advanced drug delivery, on-demand drug delivery, and those kind of applications. And so those all of these would be discussed, and researchers would be presenting papers and interacting with the industry.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should introduce again real quick all of our guests. Irfan Ahmad is the Assistant Director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at U of I. Brian Cunningham is Associate Professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. And John Rogers is Professor of Materials Science and Engineering. He's Founder Professor of Engineering, Professor of Chemistry at the U of I. We're talking about nanotechnology. And as Irfan Ahmad mentioned, there is a conference going on this week, and that's part of the reason for us here having the conversation is to talk a little bit about nanotechnology and what it is, but also to just mention that this workshop is going on. And now, for quite a few years now, you've been doing this as an annual event.
Yeah, right? We have been we have been doing this for the last 2 years, and as you would recall, that our first one was the Nanotechnology Industry Workshop, and that workshop actually then has led to industry campus collaboration, and so some of the industry has come back to the researchers and established partnerships, and this has augured very well. The center itself was put up recognizing the need for unifying the campus in terms of presenting the larger ideas for the nanotechnology development. And one of the key successes, or the stellar success of the center, has been this bringing in the nanochemical electrical manufacturing the mechanical center, which is based at the mechanical engineering. And it's an NSF center, which is $2 million per year for 5 years and extendable in the 5 years. So those kind of initiatives we have been involved with and trying to bring onto this campus. Historically, this campus has been very rich individually in working on nanotechnology, but collectively what the campus administration recognized that need, and since about 2.5 years this has been done. Mm-hmm. So last year we had another workshop which we tied it to homeland security, and so we brought in how nanotechnology avenues or research and development would be used for biosensing and detection of toxins and biotoxins, and for detection, metal detection, and so on and so forth. And so those interactions have actually led to some of the companies being formed, some of the companies coming out of the micro and nanotechnology lab, and then some of them are actually, they have worked at through the micro nanotechnology lab or associated with faculty who are associated with the micro nanotechnology lab, are based at the research park, and have since then they continue to develop further.
Yeah. And if people, I guess I should mention too, that if people are sort of interested in finding out more about the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology and what it's all about, they do have a website.
Right.
So if you have internet access, you can go there. It's www.cnst. for Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, .uiuc.edu. So you can very easily go and get a little bit of an idea of what it is that it's all about. Can we talk a little bit more about applications, I guess? Again, I'm sure that people are, maybe they're just kind of getting an idea what we're talking about. The science may elude them a little bit, but I'm sure that one of the questions they will have is, well, so what? And what exactly can you do with nanoscience?
This is Brian Cunningham. John already mentioned some of the applications that people are already very familiar with. And so, nanotechnology is used all the time for making every Intel microprocessor, every memory circuit, and every hard drive has features that are being manipulated intentionally by engineers and mass-produced very inexpensively at the nanometer scale. Some of the other applications that people are less aware of are being able to make very sensitive sensors or detecting devices that can be used for various things. And so, Irfan, you mentioned, for example, how biosensors using nanotechnology can be used for detecting toxins in the environment or as a tool that can be used in the process of drug discovery research. So that's the area that I work in primarily.
Mm. Well, I tell you what, we need to take just a very quick break here in the conversation, and then we'll talk some more about nanotechnology. The reason we need to take the break, we need to continue to remind people how important the support is, their financial support is for the radio station. So we'll do that for just a moment here and give an opportunity for people to, if they want to, they can make a call and make a pledge, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our three guests. With us this morning, all morning, has been Maeve Riley. She's the editor of Patterns. That's our program guide, and she is in Pledge Central, and I'm told, Maeve, that we just hit a major milestone.
Yes, we sure did. We hit $50,000, so that's great. That's well on our way to $150,000, which we'd like to reach by the end of this fund drive at the end of the week, but we can only do that if we hear from you, 217-244-9455. You know, David, I know we call this your show is a thinking person's show. Now, I know yesterday my husband was talking to a couple of people and they said, oh, I heard your wife on the radio and I was thinking about calling. So I'd like to urge all those people who are thinking about calling to start acting now and give us a call. 217-244-9455.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit earlier. I think I mentioned that that someone had discovered it could take many years of radio listening to public radio before someone would make a pledge. And I think also one of the things that we know is that a person that has to hear us give this little talk a lot of times before also they are moved to go to the phone. And you could make it, folks, you could make it so much easier on us if we didn't have to do the 57 pledge appeals before you'd make the call. After one or two, that should be enough. And, you know, we sit here in front of the microphones and we try to think of different ways to essentially give the same message. Sometimes we think, well, the programs should sell themselves, don't they? I mean, aren't the shows good? You wouldn't listen if you didn't think that the programs were good. Well, now we want you to take that extra step, which involves calling us and making a pledge, meaning giving us some money, helping to pay the cost of producing the program. That's it. It's really a fairly simple, straightforward proposition.
And it'll just take a minute of your time. Pick up the phone, dial 217-244-9455. Our basic membership level is $40. That gives you Patterns, our monthly programming guide, and also makes you feel good about supporting your public broadcasting station.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we're trying to do is to get people in to come into the organization who have not been supporters in the past. And we have suggested a place to start would be the $40 basic membership level. And I think someone sat down and figured out that if we could get 400 new friends, people who had never given before, and if they signed on at the basic membership level, that's $40, that would mean for us an additional $16,000.
Right.
Which is not a small amount of money. And, of course, if we could get some of those people to pledge at a slightly higher level, that number would go up. And it would also help us increase our membership base. And that's a really important idea, you know, that we over time what we're trying to do is getting as many different people as possible to be contributors. That's very important that we continue to get that number up every time that we do this.
Right.
So, again, let's give the telephone number one more time.
Okay, 217-244-9455.
All right. Thank you very much, Maeve. Here this morning in this part of Focus 580, we are talking about nanotechnology and with three guests. Irfan Ahmad, he is the Assistant Director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the U of I. Brian Cunningham, Associate Professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at U of I. John Rogers is Professor of Material Science and Engineering, also chemistry. And he is founder, professor of engineering, and they're all interested in the same area in different sorts of ways. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things I wonder maybe one or more of you can talk a little bit about is what is it that had to happen as science developed to get to the point where you could do this? Because I'm sure that before there probably were scientists who thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we could move atoms around, if we could work at that kind of level, and instead of dealing with big bulky molecules, we could be dealing with individual atoms. And if we wanted to build something from the ground up, we could build it one atom at a time. What had to happen so that you could actually get to the point where you could do that?
Could I start? Yeah. In 1959, Richard Feynman, he was a Nobel laureate, and he had proposed then as now very well-recognized article that there is plenty of room at the bottom. And that's how the thinking started long, long time ago. But then there were a number of activities or the development of equipment which occurred during the next several decades, which has prompted it. And the term nanotechnology actually was proposed by Norio Taniguchi in 1970. And then Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, in 1974 said small is beautiful and those kind of things. And then at IBM Zurich, the scanning tunneling microscope was developed in 1981 and followed by the STM and AFM, the atomic force microscope, which also led to a Nobel Prize in physics in 1986. So those advances in microscopy and others continued the development of this science. Then in 1991, Somio Ijama, the Japanese researcher, discovered the nanotubes, and there's a great deal of research now currently underway, and John Rogers and some other colleagues here on campus are actively involved in the development of nanotubes and associated activities. And then in 1996, the buckyball or the carbon fullerenes were discovered or reported by Rick Smalley from Rice University. All of these events or occurrences then prompted the development of nanotechnology. And then in the previous the government during President Clinton's time, there was an establishment of this nanotechnology initiative at the federal level. And that then led to the money being allocated to NSF and then further to other federal agencies, which was then transferred for research funding to academic institutions and also towards companies who were either engaged in or were planning to work on nanotechnology. Some of this put the United States quite ahead of other countries. But over the last 3 to 5 years, we have seen that the other countries are catching up in the sense that they are putting a lot of investment, dollar investment in terms of equipment and manpower in being competitive. This includes Europe, China, and most recently, Ireland and South Korea have come on board big time in terms of their commitment to nanotechnology research. And then some of the U.S. companies, leading companies like IBM, Motorola, HP, Lucent, Hitachi, Dow Corning, and number of other venture capitalists put in money to get this rolling in terms of the nanotechnology. And there were a lot of startups which have been created, which are also delivering some per products and some of the trousers which we currently are the stain-proof trousers or the shirts and then the glasses, the non-abrasive sunglasses and the like and lotions and all those have some aspect of nanotechnology inbuilt into it. And this has led to where we are today in terms of that. Then at the same time, what we on this campus had recognized that there are at least five critical areas where nanotechnology research would be beneficial. And one of them is in agriculture and food. The other is medical and pharmaceutical. The third is environmental and atmospheric. The fourth is, of course, in electronics and devices. And the fifth is computational. Out of those, at least the agriculture and the food and the medical and pharmaceutical areas are the key areas where it's projected to be the most discoveries would be made and would have profound effect on the way we act and interact with our environment.
Hmm. And anything else you guys want to add?
I would say that a lot of the development has been spurred by, as John mentioned, the development of faster and faster microprocessors and Moore's Law, which states that computers get faster, double in speed over a certain period of time. And that has really driven the development of tools that can be used to manipulate and observe features that people can build, getting closer and closer to the atomic scale. And then once those tools become available to semiconductor manufacturing, they seem also to fall into the hands of researchers in other areas, which has led to the development of sensors and the development of products that that aren't microprocessors at all, but still take advantage of the technology that was developed around microprocessor manufacturing. Mm-hmm. As the size scale has gone lower and lower, that's converged with biotechnology and the ability to manipulate genes and manipulate proteins and even then use a semiconductor technology to manipulate proteins or DNA molecules in such a way that you can manipulate a single strand of DNA or perform some type of biological test that allows you to see a single gene on a single strand of DNA using tools that were developed. It could only have been developed through the microprocessor industry.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing that really interests me is the idea that it would never have been possible if you could not, first of all, actually see things on that level, that small, and then had the means to manipulate them. Because before that, you could think all you want about what you thought life was like on that level, but if you couldn't see it, you couldn't do it. And then if you couldn't actually, after the fact, you could actually see it. If you couldn't move around, then you couldn't really do it. So it seemed like at least a couple of big technological hurdles that had to be in place first before we could go from thinking about what you'd like to be able to do to when you could actually do it.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting concept. And I think it really describes the reality. Sort of follow up Brian's comments. I think a lot of nanotechnology has arisen due to engineering necessity. It wasn't as if somebody sat down one day and decided, "Oh, nanotechnology would be a great field. Let me invent it," and start it like that. It was more that since the birth of the transistor, I think it's been pretty clear that smaller is better. As far as the operation of a transistor goes, mm-hmm. It can switch faster. It operates with less power at lower voltages. The smaller and smaller you get it, and so. From the very beginnings of the integrated circuit industry, there's been this push to downsize the features in the fundamental switching elements, the transistors. And again, both because you can pack more of them in a given area, but also because they have favorable operating characteristics at smaller and smaller size scales. And so all of the manufacturing infrastructure that needed to be developed in order for that to happen has really spilled over into all sorts of other disciplines and served to sort of catalyze developments in other fields. And so sort of the metrology, the capability of measuring atoms and moving them around individually has really been a direct outgrowth of the storage and the electronics industry. And I think one can make similar arguments about developments in chemistry. A lot of the outlets for the products of a research chemist are in biology in the forms of drugs or agents to image biological structures. And those biological molecules are very large macro-scale molecules. And so the push from the chemistry is to make things bigger and bigger so you can interface with biology. And so you have these things kind of converging. Over the last 5-10 years, you've really, really seen all of these disciplines end up in this same range of length scales, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization to really, for further progress. Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about now is doing manipulation on the atomic level. Is that right? This is a question from a guy who is challenged where it comes to understanding physics, but are people thinking about going to the subatomic level? Can you go even smaller? Or is that something that's just there's some sort of law in physics says, no, you can't do it. Or either we just don't really quite understand how the world works on that level well enough.
I think that would characterize it. I mean, there's a whole branch of physics, high energy physics, which is the study of particles that result from smashing atoms together. And you can produce certainly there are particles and objects that are much smaller than atoms. But I think from an engineering standpoint, it's difficult to conceive of ways to actually build machines out of those component parts. The atom is, one of the smallest stable structures with which one can build molecules or devices of various types, I think.
So perhaps there would be really no good reason to do that. I mean, if you could do it on the atomic level, maybe you'd say, well, that's just fine. We don't need to build atoms. We can start with atoms and we can build things up from there.
Yeah, maybe that. I think the engineering practicalities and the kind of devices that humans ultimately would need to interface to are probably most realistically constructed out of atoms as opposed to quarks or electrons or subatomic.
I was just asking. I'm just curious. Is most of the money now that funds this research, does it ultimately come from federal sources?
The majority of the money that coming to this campus, or as a matter of fact, any other campus, is from federal agencies. As I mentioned, NSF is one of the prime movers. Recently, the NIH, the National Institute of Health, also started a program called the Nanotechnology Center of Excellence, and they have identified targeting cancer using nanotechnology. And so, in fact, our center actually, in collaboration with cross-campus researchers and also Washington University in St. Louis, put a proposal recently to go for that center. And then the Department of Energy has put in the considerable money, and then, of course, DARPA and other federal agencies have already historically been doing that, and they have talked about various aspects of it and with new challenges concerning the security and the safety. This has prompted the new initiatives on the part of the different agencies and more projects coming about.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the state has done, the Illinois state has provided $18 million to the micro nanotechnology lab in terms of an expansion of the micro nanotechnology lab on campus. And so the construction has just begun, and it would include expansion in terms of the clean room space, and would add another layer in terms of adding bio nanotechnology to that the building. And this scheduled to be completed in fall 2006. And so the state does recognize, and the governor in his State of the State address had actually mentioned nanotechnology as an economic engine for the state of Illinois. And although Illinois itself stands seventh in the national scale in the vis-a-vis other states in terms of nanotechnology investment, but there is considerable activity going on, and with this campus as the lead campus, and then Northwestern and University of Illinois Chicago, and then there's some activity has started happening at Northern Illinois University.
We have another caller here to talk with, and I want to make sure that people who are listening understand that we'd be happy to take questions. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here is a caller in Urbana, and line one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a comment and two questions. One is, the comment is that last night I heard that somebody's setting up a Nobel Prize kind of thing with their fortune, and they announced it last night, I guess. It's going to award prizes in nanotechnology. I don't know if your guests know that or not. But that's just a question, comment. I had two questions. One is, I'm wondering, when I was reading about nanotech, there was this thing about Prince Charles coming out against it, and is getting a lot of criticism for that. But in the course of that, they mentioned that there was something happened where they found nanoparticles in the livers of research animals, I guess, over in the UK. So my first question is, I was wondering if you knew anything about that and what that was all about.
Well, anybody, can you respond to that?
Well, with any developing technology, there is a lot of the apprehension, and there are certainly groups out there, and including Prince Charles, who had commented negatively, and the whole research community in UK got after him for making those remarks. And then, of course, there is a non-profit organization in Canada which had been suggesting a moratorium on nanotechnology research. So there are, of course, these fringe groups who try to create a scare. That does not mean that we should avoid the discussion of some of the critical issues that we mentioned earlier. But at the same time, it should not be a reason for us to give up on the research and other activities that we are engaged in. And what was the other point the caller was making?
But you don't know anything about this specific instance of nanoparticles showing up in the livers.
There was some research going conducted at Rice University, where they had looked at nanoparticles in fish, and also in mice. But that was a study which clung to the lung, and so those studies have prompted that yes, there's continued reason for exploring that kind of research in terms of seeing the health effects of those who would handle nanoparticles, and that definitely when we talk about injecting materials into the body, there are healthcare concerns, there are legal concerns. And those have to be addressed, and the research is going on, and there are some other campuses which are engaged in that activity. I know I've not read in particular reference the incident that you have mentioned.
My other question was that kind of a general one. Some people think. New science is particularly good when it's particularly counterintuitive, and I was wondering if your panel had any could tell us whether what about nanotechnology might be called counterintuitive, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Somebody want to take a shot at that?
I'm trying to think of a good example.
Let me just sort of step through the questions that you had, and then I'll try to offer an example.
Sure.
The nanotechnology prize, I believe that's being offered by a guy whose last name is Kavli, who's a self-made billionaire or something like this, and he's established several research centers around the country at different universities, and I think he's had this idea for a prize, and I don't know, I think it's a neat idea, provided that it's judged appropriately and so on. As far as Prince Charles and the comments about nanotechnology, I think it's useful to make a point here that there are certainly components of research in nanotechnology where it's to really, involve new materials where toxicity is certainly issues, and that kind of thing is studied carefully. But mainstream nanotechnology, that's microprocessors. That's your laptop, your cell phone, your hard drive. All those things are hardcore mainstream nanotechnology. And so if Prince Charles is sort of coming out against that stuff, then probably should throw away his cell phone, his computer, probably shouldn't fly airplanes anymore because all the flight controllers use computers to coordinate the flights and so on. And so I think that the point is there's certainly new stuff here and new science, and you have to worry about the dangers, but nanotechnology is already here. In the latest computer chips, things have dimensions of 100 nanometers or less, and so that's what's really, really driving it. As far as counterintuitive phenomena at the sort of nanoscale, the way that the world works on those kind of dimensions is inherently counterintuitive. The way that you interact with macro scale objects and sort of Newton's laws of physics, none of that stuff applies at these shorter length scales. You can have the probability for one object appearing on one side of what is effectively a brick wall and then magically appearing on the other side with some probability that's defined by the characteristic dimensions of that wall. And so the nanoscale world is really governed by a whole non-intuitive set of physics. So it's quantum mechanically dominated. And so almost, anything you can think about would be sort of counterintuitive in terms of the way these systems operate.
Yeah, particularly for anything having to do with light, interacting with objects on the nanoscale, that taking into account the particle and the wave nature of light is required for things at that length scale.
Just one thing I guess I would mention, and I don't not intending to be a booster of nanotechnology or anything like that, but having done at least a little bit of reading about what's going on recently, I think it is fair to say that there are people who suggest that it might be possible to use nanotechnology to produce materials, things that we would use in our daily life that would actually be eco-friendly, that would be less toxic than things that we're using right now. And I think that there are people who think that nanotechnology could make a real a contribution to green chemistry in a sense. So while it may indeed be that there you have to be conscious of the fact that there can be drawbacks, there are some people who think that it could be it could result in improvements in things that are actually better, less problematic than some of the chemicals and things that we're working with today.
Well, I think that's the goal of everybody doing research in this field is to make things better, not make dangerous things that are going to kill people. And certainly that's the goal. And I think you make a good point there.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I'll just cite a few examples of the kind of projects that they have been recently funded through the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology and the Soybean Disease Biotechnology Center. Those involved collaboration with scientists and from College of Engineering and College of Agriculture in terms of trying to track grain. And so we're talking about nano imprinting or nano ID techniques in terms of how the grain moves from the harvesting from the farm to the farm gate and to the grain elevator and so on and so forth. And then they're detecting plant pathogens, they're trying to develop a case or a system, nano electrical mechanical system, to see the pathogen pathways and see the intercellular activity and how the pathogen interacts with the cell walls. And Brian and the others are working on the DNA sequencing and also using microfluidics and nanofluidics to do that. There is a group. Again, they're talking about nanotubes for stem cell research. So that gives you an example that it has a profound and a wide variation of applications and is likely to affect the way we deal with. There are groups within electrical engineering who are talking about microspheres and nanospheres for advanced drug delivery, and those they are talking about biodegradable materials using biodegradable materials. So yes, I mean there is, as John mentioned, I mean there is a whole effort and concern and realization that all of this has to be bio-friendly and eco-friendly, as you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say we're at a point where we're going to have to stop here, and we have a caller that we can't take. Obviously, this is a broad field and continuing to develop, and new things are coming along all the time. So perhaps we'll find some ways to talk about it in future. In the meantime, if people are interested in finding out more about what is happening on this campus in this area, one thing you could do is go to the website that we mentioned, the website of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. Anything else that you'd like to mention?
Or they could come to the workshop, which is open to public, and we're talking about May 5th and 6th on campus at Beckman. And some of the topics that we have covered here would be discussed in greater detail. There will be poster session, and there will be a research and development panel in the afternoon, which will discuss some of the direction from the industry standpoint and from academia standpoint.
Okay. Well, I thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Let me one more time. I'll go around the table here. We have John Rogers. He's professor of material science and engineering at the U of I. Brian Cunningham, associate professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. And Irfan Ahmad. He is assistant director at the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at U of I. Thanks.
Thank you.
The broadcast today here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Horine's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horine's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Focus 580, the show, is also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. In just a second here, we'll tell you how you can support your public radio station. First, though, we need to do this test of the emergency alert system.
Coordinated monthly test of the broadcast stations of your area. Stations are participating in a required monthly test of the emergency alert system. This system was developed to provide information to the public during an emergency. This has been a test.
What we're doing here this morning in the next couple of minutes before we hand things over to the staff of the Afternoon Magazine is encourage you to support Focus 580, not just Focus 580, but all of the other programs that you enjoy here on the radio station. Could be Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Afternoon Magazine, Sidetrack, could be any of the other various programs that we have on the station. They all need your support. If you expect to be able to go and turn on the radio and have us here, you need to understand that your support helps make that possible. Now is the time to show it. If you're not a member of the Friends of WILL, a financial supporter of the station, you can call right now, make a pledge, and make that happen. 244-9455 is the number to call. We also want to go one more time here to Pledge Central, where our volunteers are ready and waiting to take the call. And also standing by, Maeve Riley. She is the editor of Patterns, our program guide. And anybody who makes a contribution of $40 or more every month in their mailbox, they'll get a copy of Patterns.
That's right. And we try to give you information on what's going on behind the scenes here at WILL, as well as the program information for specials on AM 580, WILFM, and WILL-TV. So Patterns encompasses all three of our stations, and you can get a subscription to that if you become a member of WILL at the $40 level by calling 217-244-9455.
We are raising the money now that we'll spend on programming next year, and I mean the next fiscal year, which for us begins on the 1st of July. And we are hoping that we can raise at least $150,000 this week. And a little bit earlier, we said we'd hit the $50,000 mark. So we're certainly making good progress. But we need to keep that going. And we do that. How do we do that? We do that one call at a time by encouraging people to dial the number, again, 244-9455, and make that contribution. It's really, really important. Over and over, I guess we've said, and we have to make the point, a very strong point, that the way that public broadcasting in this country is funded is changing. We are never going to go back to the levels of government support we've had in the past. That's just not on. So that means that people like you who value the programs have to step up and say, this is a great radio station. I like these shows. I'm going to help pay for them. If you can do $40 a month, $40 contribution, that's great. If you could do $40 a month, that would be great. If you could do $75, you could do $250. You decide. The important thing is that you make that call and make that pledge, 244-9455. Well, now we'll turn things over to the staff of the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Hello there, David. Thank you very much. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with gardeners Diane Noland and Chuck Voigt. They will join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Then later this afternoon, I'll talk with writer Mark Dunn, author of Zounds, a Browser's Dictionary of Interjections. Well, now let's turn our attention to the Chicago Board of Trade. May wheat is trading at 313.5, down 1. July, 322, down 1.25. May corn, 199.75, down 3/4. July, 207.5.